from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Hepatitis C affects about 3 million Americans and can lead to liver failure, liver cancer. In December, the FDA approved a drug that seems to work wonders. The cost? $84,000 for a 12-week treatment, $1,000 a pill. The reaction to the drug's effectiveness has been overwhelmingly positive, but to its price, blistering. This hour On Point, super drugs at a super cost and the American way of healthcare. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is there a price too high to pay for a cure? How should we deal with monstrously expensive drugs? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later in this hour, we'll look at the reaction to the FDA's approval of the painkiller Zohydro, an opioid up to 10 times stronger than Vicodin. But first, joining me from New York is James Surowiecki, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. His essay in the April 28th issue is Biotech's Hard Bargain. James Surowiecki, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here's a new drug called Sovaldi for Hep C, hepatitis C. Why does it have such an uproar going on, James?
Well, it's an exceptionally effective drug, and previously, the drugs that people had to take for hepatitis C, they were typically sort of combinations of drugs, and the treatment was really arduous. It often lasted a year or longer, and it actually was not effective for a lot of people. So you have a lot of, I mean, first of all, as you said, there are more than 3 million Americans who have it, and it can actually be an incredibly serious disease. So the fact that this pill has come along, which you take for 12 weeks, in some cases you would take it for 24 weeks, and you have a cure rate, in effect, of close to 90% is pretty miraculous. So it's an exceptionally good drug. And there are actually drugs coming after it. Merck is working on one, and so is Bristol-Myers, that seem to also be having really good results, at least in clinical trials. So from a medical perspective, it was an extraordinary drug. But the reason for the uproar on top of that is that it's also a tremendously expensive drug, at least just in terms of the dollars you have to pay to get it. So as you said, Gilead, which is the biotech company that makes it, made the, I think, somewhat curious decision to price it effectively at $1,000 a pill. Mm. And so if you take it for 12 weeks, you essentially take 84 pills, and you end up paying paying $84,000, which, while it actually is not much more, or in some cases even less expensive than other treatments that previously existed for it, is still an extraordinarily large sum of money. And so that really has been the source of the controversy.
You write that it's not just a big price tag, it's a big problem for insurers and for taxpayers. How does that big price tag flow through to become a problem, James?
Well, one of the things that's distinctive about hepatitis C is that the population of people that have hepatitis C is typically poorer, and so a very large percentage of them are on Medicaid. So what you're really looking at is state governments trying to understand, you know, how they're going to be able to pay for this drug. And obviously, in the case of insurers, for those people who aren't on Medicaid but have normal insurance, you know, insurance companies are suddenly essentially presented with the case where they're going to have to shell out $84,000 or whatever it is to treat this. And United Healthcare, actually, which reported earnings, I believe, last week, actually said that the cost of this drug, even though it's only been available, as you said, for a few months, actually did make a material impact hitting its bottom line. There's one other thing that's really important about this story, actually, which is that one of the reasons why Sovaldi paradoxically is such a problem is that it is so enormously effective. So one of the familiar raps about drug companies is they build, you know, they make me-too drugs, and we're paying a lot of money for drugs that actually aren't that great or that effective.
Yeah.
That's not the case here. This is an amazingly effective drug. The problem is that it's so effective that ideally you'd want everyone who has hepatitis C to take it, because it would actually really make a huge difference in people's lives. But if you do that, you know, you multiply 84,000 by 3 million, and you end up with an absolutely massive number, 200 plus billion.
Yeah, 227 billion by one calculation here. If
right.
we gave it to everybody who's affected by hepatitis C, that is almost as much as the entire country spends on all drugs in a single year. That would be just for one therapy.
Exactly. And so obviously we're not going to do that. And what you're seeing is that in individual states, basically people are saying, you know, we're only going to give it to maybe the people who have the most serious cases of Hep C, because Hep C takes a long time to develop in terms of its really negative consequences. But in a broader sense, it really crystallizes the problem we're running into with these drugs, which is that the more effective they become and the better they are at helping people, the deeper the economic consequences, obviously, in terms of actually paying for these drugs. And the fact that they're so enormously expensive means that we have a real dilemma going forward, I think.
How do these drugs get priced? $1,000 a pill, as you intimated, sounds almost like a nice round number just picked out of some very high-altitude air.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Now, it's a very sort of rigorous, I think, to some degree, and sophisticated process in terms of, you know, the planning departments and strategic planning that they go through. But basically, the comparison they're trying to make is they're trying to do two things. One is they're comparing, the drug companies are comparing the cost of this treatment to other existing treatments. And like I said, if you looked at other existing treatments for Hep C, they were in the somewhere between $65,000 to $110,000 range, somewhere around there. So they're starting from an incredibly high priced baseline to begin with. And then the other factor, obviously, that they have to take into account is, you know, what will people be willing to pay? What is the, you know, a reimbursement rate that isn't going to completely send people over the edge? And that, I think, is where the question gets very complex, because there's a political dimension to it, you know. But, you know, drug companies have an enormous advantage. If you make a drug that's really effective and that people need, it's really hard for governments and insurers to say, you know what, I'm just not going to pay that. You know, in the United States, Medicare, for instance, is literally legally prohibited from negotiating for lower prices. So there's a tremendous amount of leverage there that shapes the decisions to price it at whatever. I think Gilead made a mistake in taking that $1,000 number. I mean, it's just too perfect a target. But, you know, they obviously were trying to figure out what's the profit maximizing price they could get.
I mean, it's funny. You have to be careful. Anyone does about being self-righteous here. You know, when disease hits someone or your family, then it's, oh, well, whatever it takes. It's interesting. There's some very high-priced cancer drugs out there, and people worry about that. Cancer hits everybody. Hepatitis C. Look, you report here that patients have an average annual income of $23,000. I mean, almost half of it tends to come from injection drug use, about a third from sex partners who are affected here. Way down there, there's blood transfusion to multiple sex partners, but it got big concentrations in prison populations. I wonder if there's a special political problem that comes up when you're looking at $84,000 for treatment and a lot of the patients are in prison.
Yeah, I mean, I think going forward, you know, that's probably going to become a bigger part of the debate. You know, obviously Hep C has become not more mainstream, but obviously it's made its way more into the sort of mass population than in the past. But it is a big difference, and I think, you know, the question about cancer drugs is a similar kind of issue. But I will say the difference here again is that when you talk about cancer drugs, and there has been a big backlash about the cost of cancer drugs too. One of the things I talked about in my piece was about a year ago, more than 100 very high profile cancer doctors wrote a piece in the New York Times and elsewhere basically saying we need to do something about the price of cancer drugs because they're completely out of control. They were specifically talking about leukemia and blood cancers and things like that. But The issue with cancer drugs is in part that, you know, you're spending a lot of money for very small improvements in many cases. You know, you're talking about maybe getting a couple months, 3 months, which obviously is a huge deal if you're going through it or if your family member is going through it. But there you're having this question of, you know, we're spending all this money and is the benefit really there? Sovaldi, again, is even more complex in a way because there's no disputing the benefit. In fact, you might even say, you know, if you can keep people from getting liver cancer and the rest, you know, you can do a mathematical calculation and say, well, you can understand why it's, you know, costs X, Y, or Z. But as you said, you know, if you think about $200 billion a year when we only spend $300 billion, on drugs entirely, it's a crazy number.
The market reaction has been fascinating here. On the one hand, this is the most successful drug rollout ever. They exceeded their first quarter revenues on Sovaldi, this Hep C drug, by more than $1 billion, by one estimate, up $2.27 billion in the first quarter spent on this. So that's the biggest since anything except Lipitor, I guess. On the other hand, that number is so big that some biotech stocks, I think, lost ground because people said, "This, if it can't go on, it won't go on. This can't go on. There's going to be something done to rein in these prices."
Yeah, I mean, that's what you just said is, you know, there's a famous quote from the economist Herb Stein said exactly that. You know, if something can't go on, it eventually won't go on. And, yeah, biotech stocks have had an incredible run over the last, say, 4 or 5 years. People have become convinced that, you know, they can generate great drugs and profits really consistently. And Gilead has been one of the biggest beneficiaries of that. But in the last, say, month or so, I mean, it really began in March, there was a very steep sell-off. Precisely because people started to wonder about the political backlash. And specifically, three Democratic congressmen wrote a letter to Gilead saying, essentially saying, why does this drug cost so much? And that really spurred, I think, the concerns that now biotech stock investors are starting to wonder, how long can this pricing bonanza essentially last? At some point, isn't someone just going to say, that's it, you know, we can't do this anymore?
One wonders if that can be done under the current American system. We'll look at that. James Surowiecki, you set us off on a great conversation here, and we're grateful for it. James Surowiecki with The New Yorker, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I appreciate it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about super expensive drugs, wildly, stunningly expensive drugs, the challenge of the huge new drug for hepatitis C, and the question of whether our system can go on, stay solvent in some terms, with drugs this expensive out there. When you need it, when it's for you, when it's your city benefiting from those profits, maybe you're all for it, but does it all even out in the end? Can we keep going down this road? You may have heard one of the ads on television from the maker of the hepatitis C drug Sovaldi. This is from the company Gilead.
There's never been a better time to rethink your Hep C. Because people like you may benefit from scientific advances. Advances that could help you move on from Hep C. Now is the time to rethink Hep C and talk to your doctor. Visit HepCHope.com to find out about treatment options and register for a personalized guide to help you prepare for a conversation with your doctor.
Sounds good. And who doesn't sympathize with those struggling with hepatitis C? Of course we do. But follow that trail and you will most likely be led to an $84,000 treatment. With me now from Washington is Dr. Steve Miller, Chief Medical Officer at Express Scripts. It's the country's largest pharmacy benefit management firm. Express Scripts handles 90 million Americans' pharmaceutical benefits, negotiates the cost of drugs on behalf of 3,500 clients, including health plans and employers and unions. One of its largest clients is the U.S. Department of Defense. Steve Miller, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
When this drug, Sovaldi, came across your desk and you saw that price tag, what did you think?
Yeah, so we've been warning our clients for the last several years that these breakthrough drugs were coming, but we were unclear about what the price would be. And in the history over the last couple of years, the prior therapies before 2011 were mainly interferon-based drugs. As James so appropriately said, they didn't work very well. They were very poorly tolerated, and it would cost about $25,000 to treat a patient.
Mm-hmm.
Several years ago, we had a whole new group of drugs, Elicio, Victrelis, Invictus. It brought the cure rates up to somewhere between 60 and 70%, but the price doubled to over $60,000. So they took a big premium because they had a better product. Now we have even better drugs out there like Sovaldi, but we're now talking about, for a treatment course, often over $100,000. And as James pointed out, if you treated all 3 million patients with this product, you're talking about more money than we pay for all drugs in the U.S. healthcare system.
So what happens when a drug this effective but this expensive comes into the system? How does the system respond, Steve?
Yeah, so, you know, what we do as a business is we accumulate members and payers, and we negotiate with the pharmaceutical manufacturers. When you have a drug that's truly better like this, then there's very little leverage. And so what we've done is we've created a coalition of our membership that's essentially said to the following. We may be stuck with this drug today, but when a competitor product comes onto the marketplace, we're going to move all of our market share to that competitor, because we believe the behavior of the pharmaceutical company isn't appropriate. This price is just not sustainable. And it leads to a bigger issue of what's the fairness in drug pricing. And that's really the debate we think we need to have.
Well, how do you measure that? Is $84,000 for 12 weeks inappropriate? $100,000 maybe for a full treatment? Is it inappropriate? In what terms? How do you decide what's inappropriate?
Yeah, so in other countries, they actually have rationale for how they do this. And I'm not saying this is right for America, but everyone is familiar with in the UK, they have what's called NICE. And NICE looks at what's called quality adjusted life years. Other people have tried experiments where you pay for outcomes. So if a drug works well, you pay for it. If it doesn't work well, you look at it as a defective product, you don't pay for it. We believe that in the United States, it has to be adding value. And what we mean by that is if a drug gives you better outcomes than what's currently available, you should be able to get the best price that's currently in the marketplace. If a drug is just as good, then it should be at a lower cost. And if you think about this, this is what other industries have done with their innovations. I'll give you a great example. Take your computer.
Okay.
10 years ago, you were using a 286 processor that cost you $2,500. Today, you're using a computer that cost you $300 that could land a man on the moon. And so it's 80% cheaper, but giving you more. There's no reason every time a drug is incrementally better, we have to pay enormous premiums.
What happens when this hits Medicaid? A lot of hepatitis C sufferers are quite low income, and many are in prison. When this shows up at the Medicaid door, are they obligated to just sign it and say, yes, fill the prescription?
Yeah, so many state Medicaid directors have reached out to us to ask, you know, what are you doing about this? Because this truly will break states' budgets. So when you think about the top populations, you've already identified there's 1 million of the 3 million patients that are underinsured or uninsured, they're on state Medicaid or newly on the exchanges. You got 500,000 people, as you pointed out, are in the prison systems. Most prison systems are funded by states. And then the third biggest population is actually our veterans, many of them Vietnam-era veterans. And so right there, you have almost two-thirds of the patients all funded by taxpayers. So the states are actually in full panic mode because, unlike the federal government, they usually have to balance their budgets. And this drug was unbudgeted, and so many of them don't know how to handle it and are trying to think of how do you ration it to treat just the sickest patients first.
And Medicaid comes right out of the general budget.
That's correct.
Steve Miller, stand by. Dr. Steve Miller with Express Scripts in Washington. With us from Philadelphia right now is Patricia Danson, professor of healthcare management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. She's co-editor of the Oxford Handbook on the Economics of the Biopharmaceutical Industry. Patricia Danson, thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
So how do you look at this? Is Gilead, the maker of this new drug, ripping off the entire country? Is this inevitable somehow in our system? Is this a wrong or a right? Help us here, Patricia.
I don't think we can blame Gilead for this. I think we've created a system that, on the one hand, really requires that companies pursue the interests of their shareholders. That's the basis of the capitalist system. But now we've put that in a healthcare system that gives comprehensive insurance coverage to individuals, but does not really empower the payers to put any sort of control on the prices that providers and drug companies charge. Now, traditionally, we've relied on consumer cost sharing to provide some sort of price elasticity in the market. But that reliance on consumer price sensitivity has broken down at this point, because when you have treatments at this sort of price range, consumers basically blow through any limit on their cost sharing. So most health plans have a limit on consumers' cost sharing at maybe $1,000 or $2,000, or even for a consumer-driven plan at, say, $5,000. Mm-hmm. And once that has been spent, they don't care whether the price is $20,000 or $80,000. And further, the companies often offer what are called copay coupons that pay for that cost sharing to get the consumer to that point of indifference. So it really is a system that relies on the payers to put some sort of brake on pricing. And in the U.S., we've been unwilling to do that. As was already pointed out, Medicare, as the largest funder of pharmaceuticals, is prohibited by statute. And even the individual very large private payers really individually do not have the market power to do it.
Patricia, does Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, make a difference in how these expensive drugs are absorbed or treated?
It probably makes it worse, because it does require a limit on consumers' cost sharing on an annual basis, and it removes these limits that payers previously have had on the amount that they will pay in a year by making it illegal for plans to have an upper limit on what they pay for covered benefits.
Steve, this is just our system. This is just the way it goes. Americans, if you want to have that posture of indifference about cost, this necessarily comes with it, these super high price tags. Do you buy that, Steve?
Well, you know, we don't believe it has to. If you look at how this drug is priced around the world, and this has actually been some of the most galling thing about this particular agent, they want to charge $84,000 in the United States. In Europe, the UK or Germany, it's 25% to 30% lower. In India, they're going to sell it for $2,500, and in Egypt for $900, and still make a profit. And so the reality is Americans have always subsidized world the medication supply chain for the world, but this has gotten to a point of almost absurdity. And so this is why payers are really up in arm. It's not because this is the most expensive drug that's come to the market, but this is probably the most threatening, because when you multiply the price times the population, it's just extraordinary.
Patricia, is this Americans subsidizing the entire world here and maybe should feel put upon, if not ripped off, by that?
That's not the way economists see it, actually. It certainly is true that there are differences in prices between the U.S. and other countries. But in some respects, that's appropriate. You know, the cost of doing R&D, which are very high, are really something that benefits consumers worldwide. And there's no principle in economics that says everybody should pay the same price. Indeed, from an equity standpoint, it seems appropriate that higher income customers should pay more. So the principle of differential pricing, I think I and most economists would support. But that still leaves the question of the absolute level of those prices, and I think that's where there is an issue here. It's not so much that there are differentials, but it's what the levels are.
Yeah, I just don't know. I mean, speaking of higher income, I'm looking here at a report. The CEO of Gilead, the company that makes this, the company that's pricing it, $84,000 for 12 weeks, John Martin, in 2013, his compensation was about $180 million. Now, Steve Miller, people hear about R&D costs, and everybody understands that, but then you hear the CEO made $180 million last year, and it's like, wait a minute.
Yeah, but you know, Tom, while that's an enormously large number, Gilead has done a fine job with this drug. It's a good drug. The bigger issue, you know, I think that would be focusing on the wrong thing. We really need to focus on how is America going to take on fairness in drug pricing? Because I will tell you that it's Sovaldi today that we're talking about, but there's a pipeline out there that's extraordinarily big. There are 5,400 drugs in clinical trials in the United States right now, more than in any time in my 30 years in healthcare. And they're for enormous classes of patients. So there's new drugs that are going to come out, for instance, for high cholesterol. There's 71 million people with high cholesterol. And so what we think is Sovaldi's just a a good example of a future that's not sustainable. And we believe that what Gilead and the other pharmaceutical companies have to do is work with us to get to a sustainable model where we still have great innovation in the United States, great care for our patients, but we don't bust the bank.
We'll look at what that might mean. But I just think $180 million compensation for a CEO is a certain kind of tip-off that this isn't all just about bench costs in R&D by any means. Steve Miller, Patricia Danzen, please stand by. Lots of listeners here. Ed in North Attleboro, Massachusetts. Ed, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. The reason why I called is that 14 years ago, I was diagnosed with hepatitis C. It was full-blown at that point in time. I was a corpsman in the service, and I got stuck with a needle than a decade before that.
Yeah.
The reason why I'm calling is that as opposed to a liver transplant, as opposed to taking somebody out of the economy that can't contribute,
yep,
and some of the treatments that were available before this new drug came out. Just to give you an example, I was on interferon and ribavirin for an entire year. I had to inject myself twice a week and take the ribavirin, I think, every day. I went from 205 pounds down to 145 pounds.
Wow.
I was effectively out of the economy, underemployed for a period of about 3 years, the treatment plus the recovery time.
It was just so debilitating, you're saying, Ed. So tough.
It was so debilitating.
Yeah.
I would have written a check. I would have hit my 401k.
Anything to get. So are you on the new one now or trying to be on Sovaldi?
No, actually, what happened was it happened 14 years ago. I was the lucky one. It was only a 20% efficacy rate in the people that went the full year on the ribavirin and the interferon.
But if this had been available, you're saying $84,000 would not have been too much to you to get out of that pain, out of that pickle?
No, because I heard one of your people on your panel say that it was $25,000 for the interferon. That it was absolutely brutal. You know, I missed the clinical trial for the interferon with PEG, which is a which would have required me to take half the interferon.
So are you clear and clean of Hep C at this point, Ed? Did you manage to get untangled from it?
Well, one of the foremost liver specialists in the country said I was cured, and they don't use that word lightly.
Well, I hope that's true. I've got to get to another caller here, but I appreciate your story, Ed, and I really hope that is true. Put yourself in Ed's shoes, and you may look at things differently, and yet there's the costs. Cindy in New Orleans. Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm really just calling to make a comment that as a healthcare provider, I'm a nurse in a hospital.
Okay.
And I see still all the ramifications of people's inability to really afford health care in general. I have a friend, fellow nurse, whose child was just diagnosed with is an autistic child, actually broke his neck in a autistic moment.
Yeah.
And the cost of treatment was a whopping one dose, $40,000.
So are the drug companies doing the right thing and coming up with these drugs and setting the prices or not, Cindy?
No, they're not. And maybe they're doing the right thing by trying to do some research and development of new drugs. But the bottom line here, really, on so many levels in this country, is that if we are all on the same page, everybody in this country should be invested personally, emotionally, psychologically in this dilemma, because so many people still don't have access to care. And the Obamacare debate can rage on and on and on, but the bottom line is we're trying to make a difference. This country's trying to change it.
Are you saying we don't have care because drug prices are too high?
Well, imagine not being able to afford this drug that's being told to this person is the thing that, you know, will make a difference. That's absurd.
Yep.
Any drug for $40,000 is absurd.
Yep, or $84,000. Cindy, I appreciate your call from New Orleans. Dr. Steve Miller, please stand by. Express Scripts' Patricia Danzen with Wharton School. We're talking about super expensive drugs and how we're going to deal with them. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about super expensive drugs, very wildly, stunningly expensive drugs, the challenge of the huge new drug for hepatitis C, and the question of how our system handles this. The new drug is Sovaldi. It's said to be 90% effective in treating hepatitis C, which affects maybe 3 million Americans. That is fantastic. On the other hand, 12-week course costs $84,000. It can be more than that. Multiply that times 3 million. You've got a number so big it boggles the mind. In a lot of states, Medicare, Medicaid are looking at this and saying, what are we going to do? Dr. Steve Miller is with us from Express Scripts. They're very big in this whole business of pharmaceuticals and prescriptions. They're looking at how we handle this. Patricia Danzen is with us from the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. She says this is baked into the American system, this difficulty. Okay, so what are the options here? Lots of response online. A listener says, didn't Jonas Salk give away the polio vaccine? Pretty big pendulum swing in social conscience. On the other hand, the biotech companies, James Surowiecki is talking about, pharmaceutical companies driving a lot of the economy. Jim says these monstrous expensive drugs are making cities like Boston very rich. But then Daniel writes to us, the issue reminds me of the movie Elysium, only the rich will survive illness. I'm not sure where this goes. Let's go to Chris in Buffalo, New York. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to... One of your panelists, when you were talking about the $180 million profit for the Hed Gyford Pharmaceutical Company, has deflected that nicely, but that really does need to be looked at, because the problem is we don't have health care. We have enforced insurance, but the pharmaceutical companies have a headlock in regards on all of us on that. The amount of money that they are making, and the amount of accountability also in regards to drugs that are not working, and if you look into the FDA and you look into the billions of dollars they're having to pay out for things that aren't, but then we go ahead and it's this Obamacare is very good for them, but it's not good for the future of our country, and it's not good economically because it doesn't create a viable business that exchanges a good product.
A headlock. We'll look at that dynamic. And Chris, I appreciate your call from Buffalo. Let me hold that for a moment. Go to Stillwater, Oklahoma. RW, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I noticed an article recently that this particular drug has about a 50% effective rate, which I thought should be purchased and applied to people because it's so much better than the older treatment. But the other thing that caught me about the article I read was that in the United States, it's going to cost us $85,000. But I thought the drug company said they were going to sell it to foreign countries for $2,000 or $3,000 per dose. Well, I don't understand why we, as Americans, are having to subsidize that in this era of high-cost health care.
Yeah, RW, I appreciate your call very much. Steve Miller, there's a what-the-market-will-bear aspect to this, and that's their calculation, I guess, and their first quarter revenues off this drug in 2014 over the moon. So they're hitting something right in business terms, but is it right, Steve?
Well, you know, Tom, we've obviously come out very strongly against this just because of the sustainability aspect of it. And we know that historically America has cross-subsidized the world with their pharmaceuticals. But you got to remember, many of the employers I represent, they have workers all over the world, and they're competing against companies all over the world. So if you're an IT company in Boston and you have to pay $84,000 for your patient to get treated, but you're competing against an IT company in India that's going to pay $900 or $2,500 for the product, it's just not going to be sustainable. And so we believe we have to get to a different level playing field if we're going to be competitive, but also if we're going to treat our own poor patients. So as you identified, many of our patients are really economically, you know, disadvantaged that need this drug, yet they're being asked to pay many, many, many times more than poor people around the world.
So we want great medicine. We want great health care. You say that the future is not sustainable if we have drugs this expensive out there, even when they're effective. What kind of change would you contemplate for the American system of pricing and paying for drugs, Steve?
Well, like we said before, we think we have to get to a value-based system. We think there's enough money in healthcare today. And so if you bring out a better product, you should get today's price. if you bring out a product that's just as good, you should actually do it at a lower price. We have to move to a system much more like what technology has done. So you have a cell phone that's much cheaper than your cell phone used to be, but it's a much better cell phone.
Yeah, but how do you get to that? Because right now they come out, it's more effective, and they charge a lot more for it, and people are stepping up as they can to do that. How do you reverse that to the tech kind of dynamic?
Right. So there's actually not going to be a single silver bullet. This goes back to how does our patent system work? How does our regulatory system work? How does the visibility to patients have in the marketplace of the price of products, so the transparency works? This is actually going to require a bunch of small fixes that along the way will make a big difference. But we also think, as your callers pointed out, that the pharmaceutical companies can take a first step just by being more responsible. I'll give you one example. Biogen, a biotech company, came out with a new drug for hemophilia in the last week, a factor IX product. It is better because it's longer acting, so people take it less frequently. But they essentially took our language and said, we are going to price this at parity. We are not going to take a disproportionate advantage. And we think that's the responsible thing that companies have to do.
Patricia, if we can't afford this path, what's an alternative that might be accepted politically, ethically, expectations-wise in the United States?
Well, I agree with what Steve said about rating prices relative to what the incremental benefit is delivered by new drugs or other new treatments. But I do think we also need to look at quantitatively what amount of benefit is delivered and set some sort of limit on what we would pay.
This is what the United Kingdom does, Britain.
Well, so the UK does have NICE that has a threshold on what they will pay per quality adjusted life year that's now in the sort of £20,000 to £80,000 range.
So how long would it let you live and how well would you live during that time? And with that calculation, here's what we'd pay.
Here's what we would pay per unit of health gain, whether it's a drug, whether it's other types of medical intervention. So that actually sets some sort of limit on what will be paid for incremental benefits.
Has America ever done that, or is the philosophy here is that, you know, an extra minute has infinite value?
In healthcare, it's tended to be that. However, there are areas where we really have put brakes on pharmaceutical pricing by putting providers at risk, for example. And so when the providers get paid a fixed amount that includes the cost of the drug, then we're putting a lot of pressure on companies to constrain their prices. So that's another way that we might go, but that puts more pressure on, say, the hospitals or the doctors, which are then financially at risk for providing the care that includes the drugs as part of their bundled payment. And that's the sort of approach that we're most likely to go down in the short run, I think. But I don't think it's a long-run solution.
Steve Miller, we've just got half a minute with you and Patricia. Do you think this Sovaldi, this Hep C, hepatitis C drug, could be, you know, the super expensive one that turns things around, or are we still on the escalator?
I'm hoping this is the one that turns it around, but I'm a little more pessimistic. I think we're still on the escalator.
Wow, how high we can go, we may find out. Dr. Steve Miller with Express Scripts joining us today from Washington. Thank you very much for your insights, Dr. Miller.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Patricia Danson, Professor of Healthcare Management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Patricia, thank you very much for your insights here as well.
Thanks for having me, too. Bye-bye.
In a moment, we're going to look at Zohydra, the big, new, very effective opiate that's got the painkiller that's got people upset in lots of ways. We'll look at that. Hey, stand by. In an 11-2 decision in October, the FDA approved a potent new painkiller, Zohydro, that is orders of magnitude stronger than any opiate now on the market. It's a combination of oxycodone and morphine. 29 states' attorneys general have asked the FDA to reconsider. Governor Deval Patrick of Massachusetts unsuccessfully tried to ban the drug in his state. We're going to look at the debate over this one. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Lisa Girian. She's covered the prescription prescription opiate addiction problem, which has got a lot of attention around the country, and cover the response to the FDA's decision to greenlight Zohydro. Lisa, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Is this on the market now?
It is on the market, yeah. Yeah, and while it is like morphine and oxycodone in that it's an opiate narcotic painkiller, it's actually a very strong dose of hydrocodone, which many of the listeners will know as Vicodin.
So they've put these two together, a narcotic and an opiate. I'm not sure I even know the difference exactly.
No. Narcotic is a broad category. Opiate kind of falls within that.
Okay.
This drug, Zohydro, is pure hydrocodone, which is sold, previously has been sold in combination with acetaminophen in a pill called Vicodin.
Okay.
Now, the acetaminophen has been taken out, and instead of getting 10 milligrams of hydrocodone, this opiate narcotic, you're getting 50 milligrams of the hydrocodone. But it is in an extended release form. It's supposed to last several hours and kind of be a controlled release into your body. The part that has people concerned is that if that's released into your body all at once, it's very, very dangerous, potentially lethal.
Why is this drug being brought to the market? Are current painkillers inadequate?
That's a great question. I think a lot of doctors would say no. The company that makes Zohydro believes that they found a niche in the market for doctors who want to prescribe hydrocodone or patients who want to take hydrocodone but don't want the acetaminophen, which can cause liver damage. They wanted to offer a pure form of hydrocodone. They say that's what they offer to the marketplace that's different. They've also made it long-acting so that you can take it less frequently than you would have to if you took Vicodin. Those were sort of the selling points that they made to the FDA and were some of the factors that they considered in ultimately approving the drug for the marketplace.
So there are the selling points. What about the pushback? Why so many states unhappy about this?
Yeah. 29 attorney generals in 29 states have basically begged the FDA to take this off the market or not approve it in the first place. In Massachusetts, Governor Deval actually issued an order banning it until a court overturned him. And their concern, and I have to tell you, lots of local law enforcement and emergency room physicians and even coroner's offices have told me that they are concerned that Zohydro is going to be the new OxyContin. And what their concern is that you have a narcotic opiate, a very, very powerful drug that is safe if it's used properly, if it's taken, according to label directions. But if addicts can take it and crush it and snort it and get that full, 50 milligram dosage all at once, and that's a powerful high, it's also very dangerous. And that's what they're concerned about.
We've been hearing so much lately about a heroin epidemic in this country and these legal pharmaceuticals, OxyContin and more, being sort of gateway opiates to heroin. Sometimes heroin cheaper than these drugs, but lots of people getting introduced on this path. Is that the fear that we'll have even more of this opiate addiction through what is now, by the FDA's sanction, a legal drug?
Absolutely. These drugs, hydrocodone, hydromorphone, Dilaudid, OxyContin, oxycodone, morphine, these drugs on a molecular level are very similar to heroin. They're practically the same drug. They're just variants of they're all poppy-derived drugs. And so they work the same way on the brain. They're potentially very helpful and therapeutic in addressing pain, but they also create euphoria and are very addictive. And so, these drugs have been a pathway to addiction for thousands of people in this country. And they have also contributed to an incredible spike in overdose deaths in this country. There are more than 16,000 people who die from overdoses involving these pharmaceuticals every year now. And that surge in deaths has driven drug deaths overall to surpass traffic fatalities in this country.
I'm reading here that the company behind Zohydra ultimately is a company called Alkermaze, which makes a drug called Vivitrol, which is a monthly injection that makes it less likely recovering addicts will relapse. This is in a column in the Boston Globe, which is suggesting what we've got here is a sort of, you know, out of one source, you're getting on the one hand a very powerful opiate that could make more addicts if misused. On the other hand, the same corporate route going back to profiting from treating addiction. Is that strange?
Well, I mean, your Boston Globe columnist certainly thought so, you know, and you have a lot of doctors and people who are concerned about the proliferation of these opiates, you know, suggesting that it's a little unseemly for a company to be profiting from both the potential cause of a problem or the cause of a potential problem and the solution. So, yeah, that is raising a lot of eyebrows.
We've had a ruling in Massachusetts that they could not ban Zohydro. What about the pushback? Is it succeeding, or is the FDA going to stick with this and kind of say, you've got to offer this whether you want it or not in your state?
Well, it's really interesting. The FDA's advisory committee recommended that the FDA not approve this drug. And the members of that committee said they were persuaded by the high increase in overdose deaths among people using these drugs. They were not impressed by the modest reduction in pain scores that were shown in the clinical trials of Zohydro, and they were concerned that the 12-week clinical trial was not long enough. But the FDA ultimately decided to go ahead and approve the drug because they said they didn't want to deny pain patients this new drug and unnecessarily penalize pain patients because a drug can also be abused. So I think for now they're sticking by their decision. They're trying to balance, you know, this really tough equation where you've got, you know, addiction on the one side and the need for pain relief on the other.
And Zohydro out there as the new kind of poster child for that tension and a lot of worries over opiates being prescribed in our country. Lisa Guerrion covers healthcare for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with us from Los Angeles. Lisa, you're terrific. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thank you for joining us as well. Always great to have you here. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.